In 1870, a journalist traveling through the interior of Paraguay wrote home to Buenos Aires with a description that has haunted historians ever since. He described villages without men, not fewer men, not older men, none. Fields left to rot under a merciless sun, roads swallowed by jungle vines. Women, dozens of them, in torn dresses and bare feet, working alongside children no older than 8 to drag the bodies of soldiers into mass graves using ropes woven from jungle lianas because there were no able-bodied men left to do it.
The air, he wrote, smelled of damp earth and decay, of graves that had not been dug deep enough.
He was not describing the aftermath of a single battle. He was describing an entire country. In 1864, Paraguay was a nation of approximately 450,000 people, landlocked, self-sufficient, and quietly prosperous. It had no foreign debt. It had built its own railways. It had established its own ironworks and a telegraph network that reached the interior. It had an army that was among the most disciplined on the continent. 6 years later, that nation was a graveyard. Historians broadly agree that Paraguay lost somewhere between 60 and 70% of its entire population during those 6 years. For adult males, the numbers are almost incomprehensible. Of the roughly 250,000 men alive when the war began, approximately 28,000 remained when it ended, a survival rate of barely 11%.
28,000.
That is not a statistic. That is a collapse of reality. A country where for every surviving man, there are entire villages of women and children, and no one left who remembers what normal life looked like. No nation in the modern era, not France in the Great War, not Germany in the Second World War, not Cambodia under Pol Pot, has lost a higher proportion of its population to a single conflict than Paraguay lost between 1864 and 1870. And yet, outside of South America, almost nobody has heard of it.
Paraguay did not lose a war. Paraguay lost the ability to exist as a normal country.
This is the story of how it happened. The geopolitical forces that made it possible. The extraordinary, monstrous, possibly brilliant man who drove his country to its own extinction. The battles that decided it. The human catastrophe that followed. And the question that has haunted Paraguayan identity for 150 years. Was any of it worth it?
To understand why Paraguay went to war in 1864, you need to understand what the Rio de la Plata Basin looked like in the mid-19th century, and why it was, in the words of one Brazilian diplomat, a barrel of gunpowder with a lit fuse.
The rivers were not just rivers. They were arteries, and Paraguay was a heart that could be strangled.
The Rio de la Plata, the River of Silver, is the mouth of a vast system of waterways that drains nearly half of South America. The Paraguay River, the Paraná River, the Uruguay River, these were the highways of a continent. Whoever controlled them controlled trade, commerce, and power across the entire southern cone. Paraguay sat at the top of that system. A landlocked nation with no ocean port of its own, it depended entirely on the goodwill of its neighbors, Brazil to the north and east, Argentina to the south and west, for access to the sea.
Pause for a moment and imagine that. Your entire country's existence, its economy, its imports, its ability to communicate with the world, depends entirely on the permission of your rivals. That was Paraguay's reality. That was the trap Francisco Solano López inherited when he became president in 1862, and he was acutely obsessively aware of it.
The immediate trigger was Uruguay's vicious civil war between two factions, the Blancos and the Colorados, a conflict so tangled that one Brazilian diplomat called the entire basin a barrel of gunpowder with a lit fuse. Brazil backed the Colorados. Paraguay backed the Blancos. When Brazil sent troops into Uruguay in late 1864 to tip the balance, Lopez saw it not merely as a regional power play, he saw it as an existential threat. If Brazil could install a friendly government in Uruguay, Paraguay would be surrounded on three sides by hostile powers. In November 1864, Paraguay seized a Brazilian merchant vessel on the Paraguay River. Lopez declared war on Brazil. Then, seeking to attack the Brazilian province of Rio Grande do Sul, he requested passage through the Argentine province of Corrientes. Argentina refused. Lopez declared war on Argentina, too. Paraguay, a nation of 450,000, had just declared war on Brazil, a nation of 11 million, and Argentina, a nation of roughly 2 million. Together with Uruguay, the combined population of the Triple Alliance exceeded 13 million. Paraguay's entire army numbered perhaps 60,000 men.
On the 1st of May, 1865, representatives of Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay signed a secret document in Buenos Aires, the Treaty of the Triple Alliance. It contained a provision that would make the war nearly impossible to end. Article 6 stipulated that the alliance would not negotiate with the current government of Paraguay. They would not make peace with Francisco Solano Lopez. The war could only end with his removal or his death.
Lopez did not know about this clause. He would not learn of it for months. By the time he did, hundreds of thousands of people were already dead. The exit had been sealed before most of the killing had even begun.
Was there a British hand in all of this? Historians have largely dismantled the theory. The evidence is thin. But the theory persists because the alternative, that this catastrophe was produced entirely by the vanity and miscalculation of regional leaders, is somehow even harder to accept.
History remembers Francisco Solano Lopez in two ways, and they cannot both be true.
In one version, he is the great defender of Paraguayan sovereignty, a nationalist visionary who modernized his country, refused to be bullied by imperial powers, and died fighting rather than surrender. His face is on Paraguay's 50,000 Guarani note. In the other version, he is a megalomaniac who dragged a prosperous and peaceful nation into an unwinnable war for reasons of personal vanity, and then turned on his own people with a ferocity that matched anything the enemy could produce.
The truth, as with most great historical figures, is more complicated than either version allows. Francisco Solano Lopez was sent to Europe in 1853. He was 26, to purchase arms and study the military establishments of the great powers. He arrived in Paris at the exact moment Louis Napoleon was crowning himself Napoleon III. The young Paraguayan was dazzled. The glittering balls, the gold-braided uniforms, the imperial pageantry. He returned to Paraguay with crates of French parade dress, crimson sashes, plumed helmets, a head full of Napoleonic imagery, and an Irish-born Parisian courtesan named Eliza Alicia Lynch. Lynch had fled the Great Famine as a child and reinvented herself in the salons of the Second Empire. She was described by contemporaries as having a Juno-esque figure, golden hair, and piercing green eyes. When she arrived in Asunción with Lopez, the local elite snubbed her as an interloping Jezebel. Her response was characteristically defiant. She set about transforming Asunción into a miniature Paris, theater, opera, European fashion, lavish balls.
During the war itself, she rode beside the troops on a white horse, a pistol in her saddlebag, often pregnant with their children. There are accounts, extraordinary accounts, of her grand piano being transported to the front, its music drifting across muddy encampments while battles raged on the far side of the river. the sound of Shokan in a jungle at war.
She did not just follow him. She outlasted the country he destroyed. After Lopez's death, she was expelled from Paraguay, spent years in Europe and the Middle East, and died in Paris in 1886. She is buried in the Asunción National Cemetery today, next to the man who took a nation down with him.
By 1868, with the Allied armies deep inside Paraguay and his own forces reduced to shadows, something in Lopez broke. He convened what became known as the Bloody Tribunal at San Fernando.
Convinced that a grand conspiracy existed among his officers, his family, and foreign diplomats, Lopez ordered mass arrests. The torture method used was called the Cepo Uruguayana. The victim forced to sit with knees drawn up to the chin, muskets lashed across the neck and under the knees, gradually crushing the body until joints and spine gave way. Among those tortured and executed, his own brother Benigno, the Bishop of Paraguay, his former Minister of Foreign Affairs, several generals. Lopez's own mother and sisters were flogged on his orders.
There was no conspiracy. The confessions were extracted by torture. By the time the tribunal ended, Lopez had killed more of his own people in a few months than some of his battles had.
He believed he was saving Paraguay. By 1868, he may have been the only man in the country who still believed that, long after it had stopped being true.
And yet, on the 1st of March, 1870, at Cerro Corá, in the remote northeast, cornered by Brazilian cavalry with perhaps a few hundred starving men, Lopez charged into the enemy rather than surrender. He was shot and lanced. His last words, in Spanish, were, "Muero con mi patria," I die with my country.
You are left in the end to decide for yourself what to make of him.
The war began with audacity.
In November and December of 1864, while the diplomatic crisis was still unfolding, Paraguayan forces launched two simultaneous offensives. One swept north into the Brazilian province of Mato Grosso, capturing forts, towns, and enormous quantities of supplies. The speed and discipline of these operations shocked the continent. For a brief moment, Lopez's strategy seemed almost rational.
The brief moment did not last.
On the 11th of June, 1865, on the Paraná River, the Brazilian fleet engaged the Paraguayan Navy. Brazil had ironclad steamships, hulls of iron that Paraguayan artillery could not penetrate. Paraguay had wooden vessels and extraordinary courage. Smoke from burning wooden hulls blackened the sky. Iron shells punched through planking, while Paraguayan crews fought back with cutlasses. Within hours, the Paraguayan navy was destroyed. Iron had beaten wood. The river that controlled everything now belonged to the enemy.
For those who study military history, Riachuelo is the moment the war was decided. Everything that followed, 5 more years of fighting, tens of thousands of additional deaths, was the working out of an already determined conclusion.
The Allies invaded Paraguay in April 1866. On the 24th of May, the armies met at a vast wetland plain called Tuyuti, the largest land battle ever fought in South America. More than 40,000 men fought for a single afternoon. Paraguayan columns screamed battle cries in Guarani across open ground into prepared artillery positions. They were not charging, they were running, because stopping meant death, and continuing meant, maybe, death a few seconds later. By evening, 6,000 Paraguayan soldiers lay dead. The grass was literally red.
Tuyuti was catastrophic for Paraguay, but the war was not over.
On the 22nd of September, 1866, the Allies made their costliest mistake.
18,000 men assaulted the Paraguayan fortress at Curupaychi in parade formation, marching in neat columns into murderous artillery fire. Within hours, more than 4,000 Allied soldiers were dead or wounded. Among the Paraguayan defenders who held the line that day was an Argentine volunteer named Cándido López, a soldier who spent his time on the battlefield sketching everything he saw. He lost his right hand at Curupaychi. He spent the next 20 years teaching himself to paint with his left, producing the most haunting visual record of the war that exists. His paintings are what we have instead of photographs.
Curupaychi bought López nearly 2 years, but by 1868, the mathematics of attrition had become overwhelming. The great fortress of Humaitá fell. Allied armies pushed north. Asunción was occupied in January 1869. López fled north with the remnants of his army.
On the 16th of August, 1869, the armies met for the last time at a place called Acosta New. What the Allies found facing them was an army of children, boys between 9 and 15 years old, dressed in adult uniforms. On their faces, painted in charcoal, false beards and mustaches, so that the enemy cavalry might mistake them for men.
They were not mistaken. Brazilian officers wrote afterward of the terrible struggle between Christian piety and military duty as they realized what they were fighting. The battle lasted 8 hours. When the Paraguayan lines finally broke, the dry grass of the field caught fire. Many of the wounded children could not flee. Acosta New is remembered in Paraguay as the Day of the Children. It is commemorated every year on the 16th of August, not as a defeat, but as an altar.
6 months later, at Cerro Corá, it was over.
The numbers, when you encounter them in history books, have a way of sliding past without fully registering. 60%, 70%, 90% of adult males.
Let me try to make them real. Imagine a town of 1,000 people. After the war, 300 remain. Of those 300, perhaps 20 are adult men. The rest are women, children, the elderly. The men who might have farmed the fields, rebuilt the houses, buried the dead, they are gone. Many did not die in battle. They died of cholera that turned entire army camps into open sewers. Dysentery, typhoid, starvation. Flies swarmed over the dying. The stench of unburied corpses hung for miles over the retreating columns.
An Argentine journalist named Héctor Varela visited Paraguay shortly after the war. His account remains one of the most disturbing documents of the 19th century. He described the road north from Asunción, lined for miles with skeletons half covered by grass. Children 8 and 9 years old living alone in ruined villages, surviving on roots and bark. Women who had walked hundreds of miles following an army that no longer existed, still clutching the possessions they had taken when they fled their homes years before.
He described a civilization in the process of ceasing to exist.
One account describes a girl, no older than 12, carrying ammunition during the day and burying soldiers at night. No one recorded her name. There was no one left to remember it.
This is what extinction looks like when it happens slowly enough for people to feel it.
Disease killed more Paraguayans than bullets did. That is almost always the case in prolonged military campaigns of the 19th century. By 1868, the Paraguayan forces in the field were so weakened by illness that some units could barely march. Medical care was essentially non-existent. Food was scarce to the point of starvation. In some accounts, people were eating bark.
And yet they kept fighting. That is perhaps the most extraordinary thing about this war. The Paraguayan resistance, in its final years, made no military sense at all. The outcome was not in doubt.
The country had already lost more than it could ever recover. But rationality had long since left this war.
Part of this was Lopez, his refusal to accept defeat, his hold over whatever remained of the Paraguayan state. But part of it was something else, something harder to name. The Paraguayan soldiers were Guarani-speaking men who used their language as a code that no Allied officer could decipher, sending battle dispatches in Guarani decades before the Navajo code talkers of the Second World War. They fought as people who had nothing left to lose, which is perhaps the most dangerous kind of fighting that exists.
In 2022, the Mercosur Parliament formed a subcommission to investigate whether what happened to Paraguay constituted genocide under international law. The investigation is ongoing. Paraguay has been asking the question for 150 years.
The war ended in March 1870. It would take Paraguay more than a generation to begin recovering. In many ways, it has never fully recovered.
The post-war settlement stripped Paraguay of territory on both sides. Brazil took the northeast. Argentina took the Chaco and the Misiones. The country, already devastated in human terms, was also physically diminished. And then came 6 years of Brazilian military occupation.
Paraguay did not just lose people. It lost time. Decades of development. The railways, the ironworks, the telegraph network, the state-owned industries that had made it uniquely self-sufficient, erased in 6 years. The foreign debt that Paraguay had entered the war with none of began to accumulate at punishing rates, extended by British banks sensing opportunity in the ruins.
With perhaps 28,000 adult men surviving in a population that had shrunk to under 200,000, the ratio of women to men reached 4 or 5 to 1 in some regions. Polygamy, never part of traditional Paraguayan culture, became an informal social reality for a generation. The labor of rebuilding, planting fields, reconstructing homes, managing what remained of the state, fell almost entirely upon women. Every Paraguayan alive today is living in the shadow of that loss, whether they know it or not.
The war's effects on the other parties were paradoxical. Brazil had won, but the war had required Emperor Pedro II to rely heavily on the military, and the military emerged with a power and prestige it had never previously enjoyed. 15 years later, in 1889, the Brazilian army overthrew the monarchy and declared a republic. The seeds were planted in the mud of the Paraguayan campaigns.
Paraguay in the 20th century continued to carry the weight of the 19th. The Chaco War of 1932 killed an additional 35,000 Paraguayans. Then came Alfredo Stroessner, whose dictatorship lasted from 1954 to 1989, ruling over a country where the culture of authoritarian survival had been forged in the fires of the Triple Alliance War.
It was under Stroessner that Lopez's rehabilitation was completed, placed on the currency, streets named in his honor. For many Paraguayans, to condemn Lopez is to suggest that the deaths of 300,000 people were for nothing. That psychological trap has persisted for 150 years.
In 2013, Brazil returned some spoils of war to Paraguay. The Christian cannon, forged from the melted church bells of Asunción, captured by Brazil in 1868, remains on display at Brazil's National History Museum in Rio de Janeiro. Asunción is still waiting.
I want to end not with conclusions, but with a question, because this war, perhaps more than most, resists easy conclusions.
In the autumn of 1866, after Curupaiti, Francisco Solano López met with Allied commanders at a place called Yataiti Corá. It was one of the very few moments when peace was genuinely possible. Lopez, by some accounts, was ready to negotiate. He had lost the initiative. He knew the war was going badly. He was prepared to accept terms.
The Allied commander, Argentine President Bartolomé Mitre, refused. The Treaty of the Triple Alliance required the removal of López as a precondition for peace. López would not agree to his own removal. And so the meeting ended, and the war continued. And in the 4 years that followed, far more people died than in the 2 years before.
Who bears responsibility for that? It is easy, and not entirely wrong, to place it on López. He started the war. He extended it beyond any rational justification. He executed his own people in paroxysms of paranoia. He sent children to die at a Costa New with charcoal painted on their faces.
But the Treaty of the Triple Alliance made peace structurally impossible. The Allies needed López's removal to satisfy a secret agreement made before the killing had properly begun. He could have surrendered his command, his country, his life. The war might have ended sooner. But the terms of the alliance were not about peace, they were about dominance.
The War of the Triple Alliance produced in the photographs of Javier López and the paintings of Cándido López one of the most extraordinary visual records of 19th century warfare in existence. It generated propaganda newspapers, some printed on scraps of wallpaper when nothing else remained, that are among the rarest historical documents in the Americas. It generated diplomatic correspondence, military dispatches, eyewitness accounts of astonishing detail.
Almost none of it is widely known. Almost none of it has been seen by the world. History has a way of remembering the catastrophes that happened to powerful people in powerful places. The trenches of the Somme, the beaches of Normandy, the ruins of Hiroshima. These are seared into collective memory because the nations that suffered them had the resources and the global reach to make the world remember.
Paraguay, in 1870, had none of those things. It had barely survived. And so the greatest proportional catastrophe in the history of the modern Americas became, in the words of one historian, a footnote.
Some countries remember their tragedies because they are powerful enough to make the world remember. Paraguay was not. Until now.
If you want to go deeper into this history, and I hope you do, the best place to start in English is Thomas Wiggum's The Road to Armageddon, the definitive scholarly account of the war's final campaigns. For the military and material history, Gabriele Esposito's volume in the Osprey Men-at-Arms series is excellent and richly illustrated.
For visual documentation, the UNESCO Memory of the World Archive holds the iconographic and cartographic records of the war, paintings, maps, watercolors, most of it digitized and available online. Cándido López's paintings are held at the Museo Histórico Nacional in Buenos Aires. If you ever find yourself there, they are worth the visit.
Two documentaries are worth your time. Cándido López, Los Campos de Batalla, the Argentine documentary from 2005, and Contra Paraguay, a 2014 Argentine film in which a historian travels to the battlefields and speaks with the people who still live alongside this history.
Thank you for listening to The Last Army of Paraguay. If this history moved you, if it made you angry or sad, or simply made you want to know more, share it. This is a story that deserves the audience it has never had.